This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Today marks 1 week since the wildfires tore through Maui, leveling the historic town of Lahaina and killing at least 99 people. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti.
Tuesday morning, 6:37 a.m., a three-acre fire breaks out near Lahaina Intermediate School. 2 hours later, it's declared 100% contained. But with forecasts calling for wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour, four schools in West Maui were closed due to the powerful winds from Hurricane Dora. 3:30 p.m., hours later, the fully contained fire, which may have given residents false hope, flares up. God. All the while, active power lines are down. They were never shut off. Alert sirens designed to warn residents of an emergency sat silent.
President Biden says he'll soon visit Maui, but doesn't want to interfere with the recovery effort. Former President Trump and 18 associates are being allowed to voluntarily surrender by noon on August 25th after being indicted in Georgia's election meddling case. Among those charged is former Trump Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. CBS's Graham Cates has more on a motion filed by Meadows to move the case.
What they were doing was arguing that the charges against him in this kind of sweeping racketeering case against not only Meadows, but his former boss, former President Donald Trump, involve his service at the White House when he was the chief of staff for Trump. And they say because of that, the case belongs not in local court, but in federal court.
North Korea claims the U.S. soldier who fled to the North last month after an assault conviction in South Korea did so willingly. Reporter Alex Jensen in Seoul.
Travis King was supposed to be on his way back to the U.S. when he dashed into North Korea while on a border tour on July 18th, and nothing had been heard of him since. But now the reclusive nation state media insists he's seeking refuge in North Korea or a third country after claiming inhuman mistreatment and racial discrimination within the U.S. Army.
Hollywood studios offer a counterproposal to screenwriters in an effort to end the WGA strike, but both that one and the SAG-AFTRA strike will go on, as CBS's Matt Piper reports.
Striking SAG-AFTRA members.
What do we want?
On the picket line as the one-month mark hits. During a virtual roundtable with the media, union leadership says they're eager to get back to the table, but say the studios still won't budge on major issues. Jeff Torres is a member.
We just want, like, fair residuals. We want a compensation for as much money as they're making. We want to be making money for that, too. It seems fair.
The WGA, meantime, could be closer to a deal. That union is evaluating a counterproposal from major Hollywood studios that, if agreed upon, would allow union members to resume working after more than 100 days of their walkout.
Stocks fall on Wall Street. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Kuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. The city of Eau Claire is considering charging for parking downtown. The city council could take up the proposal as soon as October. WQOW-TV reports downtown business owners are largely against the measure, which they said comes too quickly after new parking regulations were put in place 2 weeks ago and after delays in construction of the city's transit center downtown left downtown roads blocked for months. A petition against paid downtown parking has generated hundreds of signatures. A Chippewa Falls woman is sentenced to jail time after stabbing her husband in 2021. 35-year-old Ashley Dietrich was charged after the stabbing in October of 2021, where court documents say she used a kitchen knife to stab her former husband and left a suicide note. Prosecutors said that it was an attempted murder-suicide. A plea deal Monday reduced one of the charges, and the other, attempted homicide, was dismissed but read in. Dietrich will serve 3 months in jail and have 3 years of probation. Her former husband filed for divorce shortly after the charges were filed. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
It doesn't hurt, feels good to help. And when you give blood, you provide a life-saving difference for others. The need doesn't take a summer break, so we have a challenge for you, started by Civic Media's Earl Ingram.
Congratulations to all those people and all of you who donate blood.
Take a selfie while giving blood, then post it along with hashtag Civic Pints. Give blood and you could get a prize too. Find challenge details and a donation center near you at civicmedia.us/giveblood. civicmedia.us/giveblood. You've heard the word a lot lately, but what does it mean to be arraigned. The Department of Justice describes it as the first court appearance for someone facing criminal charges. A judge reads those charges, then the accused enters a plea. At the end of an arraignment, a trial date is set along with bond. And depending on the severity of the charges, the judge can add conditions to take away the defendant's weapons or passport before being released. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
It's summertime in Wisconsin, and whatever the weather, it will impact you and your plans.
Should I water the garden? Will our event be rained out? Count on your local Civic Media radio station for in-depth details and the most up-to-date forecast.
Temperatures are rising into the mid and upper 70s under sunny skies.
It's your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
There who are so-called originalists, textualists, are delighted about the decision since it honors the words of the Montana Constitution. You're welcome. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I keep coming back to 19 people indicted, Trump and 18 of his Klan members, and 30 unindicted co-conspirators. And I want the names. I eventually want to know, because this could be like a bingo game, if you will. I want Lindsey Graham to be on there somewhere. There's a bunch of people I want to be somewhere on the Scott Perry. My congressman would love to see that. But I know this is a Georgia case. This is here. But this is a wide net that Fannie Willis has cast, and much wider than the DOJ, than Jack Smith and that, which is why I'm going to find it interesting to see where she goes with all this and how many rats actually do jump ship. But here to share some thoughts on the indictment, what it means, and, you know, just how big this is. I've asked Aaron Sherb to come talk with us. Aaron's the Senior Director of Legislative Affairs with Common Cause. You can check out their website, commoncause.org. Aaron, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me again, Rick.
So, you know, I'm looking at this. This is a massive indictment. Was it 98 pages? You've got 19 people, you know, named, indicted, 19, 30 unnamed co-conspirators. It's almost like the whole Republican Party's been indicted.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a very comprehensive investigation. Look, this was 2.5 years in the making. You know, hundreds of witnesses, you know, thousands of pages of evidence that were reviewed diligently by, you know, career civil servants whose mission is to uncover the truth and to achieve justice. And so, you know, this is a very comprehensive investigation that was undertaken here. And, you know, as you know, this is the fourth indictment for the former president. It's a sad day. It's a tragic day in American democracy when he was indicted. This is his fourth indictment in this year. He's now been indicted on or faces like 91 different felony counts for an array of crimes across four different jurisdictions. And so it's really a sad day. The first time ever a former president has been indicted this year now. And again, this is the fourth time.
Yeah, but you know, this is unprecedented. I mean, you know, not in my lifetime have I seen the kind of behavior we saw on January 6th. Look, there have always been complaints of, hey, you know, this happened or that happened, but everyone always said, hey, you know, we lost the race. You know, we're gonna come back and we'll fight next time. There's always been that kind of that sense that, you know, the rule of law, the tradition of a peaceful transfer of power, that was more important than petty grievances, than self-centeredness. until now. And that's why I think this is so important. I think this is a moment in, you know, 50, 100 years, our great-great-grandchildren are going to look back and go, wow, look how bad they were. And I want to be on the right side of history, I think.
Yeah, look, I mean, the former president is an extreme danger to U.S. democracy, to political norms, and the peaceful transfer of power, and, you know, and the rule of law. You know, look, now he must be treated as any other American would in the legal system. You know, he'll get his day in court and is presumed innocent until, you know, proven guilty by a jury of everyday Americans. But, you know, these are extremely, extremely serious charges here, you know, not only in Georgia, but in the three previous indictments as well.
Now, Trump put out on Truth Social that there is going to be a large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report on the presidential election fraud, which took place in Georgia. It's almost complete, I guess, and it's going to be presented on Monday. It's conclusive. It's a conclusive report. All charges should be dropped against him and others, and he will be completely exonerated, according to his post. And he wants to go after the real riggers. And I'm going, you know, I look at the real riggers and I look at what Republican legislatures have done across this country with vote suppression and I mean, purging voters and, you know, all of the schemes that they've come up with. We don't talk about any of that stuff. So I'm curious who he sees as the riggers.
Yeah, well, you know, he knows he lost the election. He was already planning this even before the November 2020 election. They were laying the groundwork to try to claim, you know, various conspiracy theories and various, you know, quote unquote voter fraud, which they knew was basically non-existent. So this is a plan in place that they were formulating before the election even happened. And so I think that goes to show that, look, this is all about him holding onto power, him putting himself above the rule of law and thinking that he's, you know, essentially a king or a monarch, and that, you know, the will of the people, the will of the voters just don't really matter. And, you know, the whole the insurrection, the, you know, the attempted coup at the Capitol was just a big attempt to, you know, basically ignore the will of the people, ignore the will of the voters, and trying to, you know, when he called Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in Georgia, a Republican, lifelong Republican, and told him to find, you know, 11,780 votes, I believe, you know, the Republican Secretary of State stood up for the rule of law and stood up for the, you know, the millions of voters in Georgia and said, no, we, you know, Mr. President, we are not ignoring the will of the people. And so I think, you know, this, there'll be more details like that come out in an eventual trial for this case in Georgia. But, you know, ultimately it comes down to respecting the will of the people and the voices of the people.
Yeah. So my mind keeps going, of the 49 people who are involved in this, how many of them are jumping ship as we speak? Because, you know, as it's been explained to me, Fannie Willis has used this tactic in the past. And that number, that large number has been dwindled down to a smaller number with all those other people turning state's evidence. Do you expect that to happen here?
Well, I think, you know, certainly, you know, a prosecutor has a certain number of tools at one's disposal to, you know, they're obviously, this is a very comprehensive investigation. This just did not occur overnight. They've obtained, you know, thousands of pages of evidence, you know, conducted hundreds of interviews. And so, you know, she and her team have, you know, likely significant information that points, you know, that implicates a number of individuals here. And so I think they'll certainly, you know, it's hard to know their strategy exactly, but I think, you know, we'll see that play out, you know, as the trial date approaches, whenever that might be.
Yeah. I had a lawyer friend say that his concern is that this is so big, that there's so much here that it's easy to get lost in what, you know, what the point is. Do you have any fear in that this is so comprehensive, that this is so big, that you may not be able to whittle this down to get a jury to understand it?
Well, sure. I mean, the former president has a long-standing record of trying to delay, of stretching things out, of, you know, making, you know, certain process arguments here. But again, ultimately, it comes down to respecting the will of the people, respecting the will of the voters, and, you know, making sure that their voices were heard and are heard going forward, and that something like January 6th can never happen again. And so I think, you know, ultimately this is, you know, about the rule of law and accountability. And we have a judicial system in place as imperfect as it is in times, but, you know, there's a legal process in place and, you know, justice is being carried out here right before our very eyes.
Yeah. Well, as they say, the wheels of justice, you know, churn slowly. And here we are seeing them turn very slowly. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Aaron Sherb. He's Senior Director of Legislative Affairs at Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. And talking about the wheels turning slowly, you know, almost the second I heard about the fake electors, I'm like, why aren't they locked up? Why haven't we tried them? I know Dana Nessel, the attorney general in Michigan, has charged their fake electors. Now you're seeing these fake electors. I'm still curious why the day they handed in their homework, someone didn't go, wait a minute, this is wrong. Arrest those people. But here we are, finally someone looking at these fake electors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, justice sometimes takes a long time to achieve. And, you know, our legal process, it takes a while to, again, to gather evidence, to conduct interviews, to do research, to find information. You know, a lot of these people didn't necessarily weren't forthright in handing over information immediately when they were asked for it. So, there's a subpoena, subpoenas take time. And so I think, it's important to get this right, to get the details of this investigation right. And again, it's, sometimes there are inefficiencies in our legal system, but ultimately I think, justice will be served here, and, the former president will be ultimately held accountable for his actions.
Any chance this gets moved to federal court?
Hard to tell. You probably saw, the former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, requested his trial at least be moved to federal court and tried to, to dismiss that. But, hard to know exactly.
The reason I bring that up is, what's the difference then? Explain the difference between, doing this in a state court or a federal court. I mean, it's the same prosecutor, same charges. What would be different?
Well, there are a couple, so one of the charges that the former president faces is under a RICO Act, or, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. It's a state law. The former president, if he becomes president again, or a future president, could not pardon him for, under that state law. So that's kind of one angle or one dynamic. I think also the former president thinks that ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, if something eventually gets up to there, I think, since he appointed three members of the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, I think he thinks that they will somehow be more favorable to him in the end. And I think, given the number of federal judges that he appointed to the court, I think he, somehow expects or demands a certain loyalty from them. So I think that's part of the calculus, at least, for trying to switch this to a federal court.
Yeah. Anything in this indictment that surprised you? Anything that caught your attention? Because, there's been a lot of talk about what was going to happen. I think a lot of people knew the RICO thing was going to be the direction they went. Anything surprise you?
Well, I think just the number of co-conspirators, both named and unnamed, in here. Like you, I'm very curious about those, all these other ones who are unnamed in there. Obviously, this was not just a one act show. There were many people who were involved in scheming, conniving, developing these conspiracy theories to try to overturn the election and overturn the will of the people. So I think there's certainly a lot more people who could be implicated here. So I think those names will potentially come out as the trial approaches.
Now, on the democracy front, and I know Common Cause is an organization that fights vehemently to maintain our democracy and voting rights and all of this. Why is this important? Why? Because I have a whole bunch of my Trump supporter friends say, well, this is a political witch hunt. You've heard all of it. But their bottom line is, we don't really need to do this. It wasn't a big deal. We should just let sleeping dogs lie. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, Trump was unsuccessful in his attempted insurrection and coup in 2021. He's learning things. They're next time they're learning things, they may try it again. And so, if there aren't penalties, if there isn't accountability for the bad actors last time, somebody else is going to do it again. If not Donald Trump, somebody else in some party, down the road. So they have to be held accountable. They have to be punished for the attempt to overturn the will of the people, or else it's going to green light some other future insurrection.
No, I mean, it's an excellent answer. But the other part of this is my concern is someone a lot smarter, someone a lot more tactical, a little more strategic, someone, not as blatant, not as outward, not as open, may try this in the future and actually get away with it. Someone, because I got to tell you, I think, someone who wasn't as extreme as Trump, I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, look, he's creating a playbook. We're in completely uncharted territory here. And so, you know, like you said, you know, somebody smarter, more devious, you know, who's had experience in government before, you know, who, you know, can marshal the resources to try to pull something out like this off again. Yeah, totally, totally worry about that as well.
Yeah, but here's the thing. One of the defense arguments that I'm seeing, and maybe you've seen it too, is, well, he didn't know any better. You know, he's just listening to advice of counsel. Do you think that holds water at all, given the fact that he ran a campaign on lock her up and all of the stuff that he had done? Does that hold any water?
I mean, that's rubbish. I mean, you know, there are documents, you know, saying that they, you know, their communications that they were planning this before the, you know, I think several months before the 2020 election, that they were already planning to like lay the groundwork by invoking, you know, quote unquote voter fraud. And so, you know, this is, you know, fed into the big lie. And so they were kind of laying the groundwork for this, you know, months before the election even occurred. So I think, you know, who's to say they won't try that again or aren't already trying to do that again for, you know, for November 2024, if he again is the nominee next year.
No. So, you know, here's the last line of questioning I've got for you, because, you know, again, I paid attention to, you know, what was being said on January 5th. You know, I was watching Parler. I was, you know, seeing some of the 4chan comments. There was a lot of violent talk. We're starting to see that happen again. In fact, you know, it was just reported that, you know, on 4chan, they're talking about the grand jury as a, you know, the names that were released as a hit list. They're going to go all Turner Diaries on them and all this. Are you concerned about the potential violence of the kind of heated rhetoric and the kind of accusations you see from Trump and his supporters?
Absolutely. I mean, we see that across all sorts of social media platforms, and, you know, Common Cause has an extensive anti-misinformation and disinformation, you know, attempt to try to flag, you know, not only violent posts, but also, you know, telling voters to vote at an incorrect location, or, you know, trying to, you know, get them to vote on a different day than the actual election day. So we have an extensive, you know, network to try to push back against some of those things. But, you know, to your point, you know, absolutely, you know, violence, you know, trying to invoke or, you know, call his supporters to violence if he doesn't get the outcome he likes is of course, an outcome that we have to be very wary of. And, you know, hopefully, you know, I think this time, you know, certain law enforcement agencies were caught off guard. I think, you know, this next time, hopefully, I think, you know, people will be fully prepared in a way that everybody wasn't fully understanding for January 6th.
I sure hope so. I sure hope you're right. But it's going to be an interesting couple of months, maybe even a couple of years watching this. And hopefully it will be live on television and we can all participate. But more importantly, see with our own eyes and hear the testimony that's being played out in a courtroom with people who are sweared in under the penalty of perjury, not on the F channel, not on social media, but actually in a court with the threat of perjury for lying. I think that's important. But Aaron, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as this continues down the road.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
Thanks so much, Aaron Sherb. He is the director, senior director of legislation at the Common Cause, commoncause.org, the website, if you want to take a look at the work that they do. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break, right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, one of the things that's kind of concerning me is, look, you had Parler, you know, which wasn't really a big player back in 2021. There were a lot of crazy people on there, and they felt quite emboldened to say all of the hateful, angry, racist kind of stuff that they were doing, make all the threats, and it was a free for all. I now look at the fact that the right has taken over Twitter because Elon Musk bought it so that they could destroy it and turn it into a right-wing free-for-all. Now, understand, this is the weird part about this. You know, Musk keeps saying, well, I bought it because I wanted to promote free speech. I wanted everyone to have a say. And then immediately says, well, you can have more say if you give me money. You give me the 8, 10, 12 bucks a month, whatever it is, and we'll give you a blue check mark, and you'll get 30 times or 35 times more views than a person who just gets it for free. Remember, it was about free speech. Never mind the irony of having to pay for your speech under the guise of free speech. But now you start seeing that people who have done the research on this stuff, that hate speech is massively increased, use of derogatory terms and what they are, all of those words now through the roof. Of which, look, to be honest, I would prefer you tell me who you are. So go ahead, say whatever you got to say. This way, I know who you are. Back in the old days, I had a friend who, old black guy, from Georgia, oddly enough. I was probably in my early 20s. He was in his 60s. And he said, look, I preferred it much better when they would just walk up to me and call me the name that they were thinking instead of smiling to my face and stabbing me in the back. And that stuck with me. I would rather people be open and honest about how horrible they are. And this is where I guess social media has allowed that to happen. I've been saying for the longest time, social media has allowed people to be the worst version of themselves because there's this thin veil of anonymity. Now, sadly, that has transitioned into people are just turning into the worst versions of themselves. But I bring up the Musk thing because, again, free speech. Remember, this was all about free speech. He paid $44 billion for Twitter, turned it into a $20 billion company. Again, it was about it's about free speech. Report today that evidently the company formerly known as Twitter, because it's now X, evidently they've been caught throttling certain websites back. So if you link to the New York Times, for instance, they're throttling that back so that it takes you longer to see it, so that maybe you give up on it, because we're in this instantaneous world. Now, me, if I want to see something, I'll wait for it, or I'll refresh it a couple of times, or I'll look for it somewhere else. If you're throttling me back, I now want to know why. But they understand through their algorithms and through their data collection that most people aren't like that. Most people, if it's a couple of seconds, by screw it. Next. Evidently, a lot of news organizations, a lot of the competitors, I guess Facebook is one that they've targeted as well. This is another one of those moments where be honest about what it is. Musk bought Twitter to destroy it. That was it. And to turn it into a right-wing space, to turn it again into another place that's powerful enough, because Truth Social, there's nobody there. The Gab, there's nobody there. There's nobody in these right-wing spaces because, well, there's no fun in just having an incestuous pool of incels yelling insults at each other, which is what those other sites are. I have a Truth Social account. I don't think I've ever posted there. Maybe something right at the beginning, I'm here, but I don't spend time on it. I get it so I can look at some of the craziness, so I can ghost and look at how extreme these people really are. And this is one of those kind of moments where you just, you look at this and you ask yourself, what was the point? You know, why did he buy Twitter? He bought it to destroy it for this moment. Because you know what was trending on Twitter today? And it's not even about, you know, small hashtags. You know, it was something like, you know, Trump 2024 must happen right now, or some, you know, sentence on a hashtag. It was about giving Trump cover. And we're going to see an awful lot of, you know, just vile, vile stuff. My email box has been filling up with more and more. Because I do think we have to hold him accountable. I do think he has to be beaten at the ballot box. But I do think in the court, not just the court of public opinion, but in an actual courtroom, he does need to be held accountable. If for no other reason than to send the message to future wannabes that we're not going to tolerate it. We're not going to allow it. Just my thoughts. Want to hear yours. Miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1989. That was the day that Jerry Horgan was killed while walking the picket line. Jerry was a chief steward for the Communication Workers of America Local 1103. The communication workers were on strike against telecom giant NYIAX Corporation, which became part of the present-day Verizon Company. At issue was management's proposal to shift a greater share of the healthcare costs onto the backs of workers. The strike wore on for a total of 17 weeks. In total, nearly 60,000 telephone workers in the Northeast participated in the walkout. These included both CWA members as well as members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Jerry Horgan was part of the strike in the town of Valhalla, New York, about 25 miles north of New York City. Jerry was struck by a vehicle driven by a strikebreaker while walking the picket line. The driver was the daughter of one of the company's managers. She was never charged for hitting Jerry, although some at the scene claimed she accelerated after hitting him with her car. One witness, Charles Pierce, recalled that Jerry was run down like a dog. The CWA honors Jerry's memory by wearing red t-shirts. In 2010, a CWA article titled "Why We Wear Red" explained, quote, "The idea started small. We asked our members to wear red on Thursday to remind the company of the blood they had spilled and to show support for our fallen brother. But it quickly spread nationwide as a sign of solidarity every Thursday at CWA locations. Jerry Horgan was killed standing up for the rights of workers and fighting for a better tomorrow for all workers." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
When your political opponents push extremist public policies that would be disastrous for America, should you wring your hands in dread or applaud? Consider Project 2025. Put together by former Trump officials and the Koch brothers' network of billionaire plutocrats. Their strategy is to win the presidency next year by demonizing all environmental protections and promising to halt all national efforts to cope with the obvious crises of climate change. Their proposals include repealing regulations that curb fossil fuel pollution, terminating our nation's transition to renewable energy, shutting down all environmental protection agencies, encouraging more oil and gas use, and promoting the deadly delusion that global warming is not a real problem. Moreover, they intend to implement Project 2025 in the first 180 days of a right-wing Republican presidential term, obviously anticipating that Donald Trump will be that president. "We're not tinkering at the edges," brags a far-out right-wing group that instigated the scheme. "We are writing a battle plan and we are marshaling our forces." They've already drawn up a list of agencies and policies they'll begin eliminating on day one. And they've readied a list of some 20,000 right-wing henchmen to put on the federal payroll immediately to enforce their plan. If this sounds ludicrous, it is. But it's actually happening. For the Republican Party has decided to be ludicrous. As the director of Project 2025 told the New York Times, "This is where the conservative movement sits at this time." This is Jim Hightower saying, maybe, but it damn sure won't sit well with the American people, who are presently suffering the hellish ravages of our rapidly overheating climate. Indeed, here's a great chance for Democrats to demonstrate their bipartisan spirit by doing all they can to publicize the Republicans' let-it-burn global warming policy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this article over at Freight Waves that grabbed my attention. Because as you know, we've been talking about the UPS Teamsters contract, which has seen really significant increase in wages, air conditioning going to come into the trucks, lots of really good stuff. And I saw this article at Freight Waves that said, a former contractor at FedEx is saying, hey, if you want to compete, you're going to have to up the pay for your drivers. And he's saying at least a 15% bump in compensation. Now, the weird thing is, I just talked to a FedEx driver who was telling me that, you know, they get crummy pay, the conditions are terrible, the vehicles are terrible. But, you know, $49 an hour, I don't even know what I would do with that. Which, again, puts me in this place of, you know, we as working people so undervalue our worth and our labor. And here to share some thoughts on, well, maybe how we get to a place where we start valuing ourselves, and about this contract, which I got to tell you, at this point, I'm not seeing a downside yet. But that's why I've asked Tony Rosario to come talk with us. Tony's an organizer with Teamsters Local 804, their website, teamsterslocal804.org, the website. Tony, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate you having me on the show.
So what do you make of this? I mean, you know, you've got a contractor for FedEx going, hey, you know, if you want to keep good people, you want to keep quality people, your contract hasn't even been ratified yet. They're already saying we got to compete. We got to bump wages up. It's already having an effect.
You know, and it's so important. I mean, we took a lot of time in building this campaign out. We're talking about a year's worth of campaigning for this contract, literally 1 year out from the anniversary of the 1997 UPS strike, which I was a young 23 year old, young kid at UPS loading trucks. And actually, you know, at that time I started in 94. So 3 years later was the strike. And I was about a good 22, 23 years old during that strike. And, you know, I say to myself, these are the kind of things that it takes to show these corporations that they have to give us what we deserve. And I love that we were able to get new leadership, you know, and Sean O'Brien and that slate, the Teamsters United slate, they did such a great job of getting the members together, having these practice pickets, also with the coalition, also with Teamsters for Democratic Union, which was just like a marriage made in heaven, just people trying to make a difference. And we did. And I mean, all through this contract campaign, you could feel it, you could see it. All the escalating actions. When we were out there rallying for Martin Luther King Day, rallying to get air conditioning in our vehicles, and then, you know, leading up to the practice pickets over the last few months, I think the company knew that we were serious, that this was a credible strike threat. And it was time for them that they were going to have to pay the drivers what they deserve, and they were going to give us what we want. We weren't going to just settle for it. We were going to take it. And I believe that's what we did. And I'm very proud of it. It raised the standards for everyone. And that's why you're hearing what you're hearing, Rick, because people know these drivers are going to be making good money. Even the part-time workers inside are making a solid salary. And it's not just the amount of the money they're getting. It's the benefits that come with it. It's the whole package. It's actually having money towards a pension. I can promise you, Amazon workers, no matter what they're paying them, they're not getting good benefits and they're not getting a good pension. So, and when you hear about talking to FedEx workers, same thing. They know what's here on this side of the fence. So, hey, if you're looking to organize and you're tired of what's happening with your company, you know, call the Teamsters. We'll be out there. We're looking to help everybody.
No, I mean, this contract should be that. This contract should be that going, hey, this, you should want this. But you know, if I could just correct one thing, I don't think your members deserve it. I don't think your members deserve the wages they get. I think they earn it. There's a huge difference. You should be demanding what you earn. And I think UPS read the room. We're in a time right now in this country where workers, at least some, are saying, you know what? You called us essential. You called us frontline heroes. You patted us on the back. You gave us all of these wonderful words. How about backing that up with the wealth that we create? And I think they read the room and rightly so came back with a good contract.
Well, and you're absolutely right, Rick. But even with all that, you know, funny enough, contract negotiations broke down quite a few times between our national negotiating committee and the company. You would think that after hearing what you said, you would think that they would have just came to the table knowing this and saying, hey, you know what? You're right. You guys deserve this. But no, it was fighting. They were fighting back and forth, tooth and nail, till we got what we got. I mean, negotiations at around, I believe, July 5th had broken down at 4:15 a.m. It wasn't looking good. I thought we were going to strike. Yeah. I was like, that's it. It's pretty close to the deadline. You know, how much closer can we get? Just a couple of weeks away. And sure enough, a week later, they called up and they, we got a lot out of this contract. I could tell you, Rick, I've been with the company UPS 29 years. I'm a 29-year Teamster. And this is the best contract I've ever seen in my life before my eyes. And I get that every year we're trying to step to the next level, right, Rick? But I can promise you a couple of years under the Hoff administration, that just wasn't happening. So to see where we're at now, to where we came from, I am super excited about all the work that was put into this contract.
Now, here's the important part. And all the work that you did, all of the internal organizing, this is the kind of stuff that I've been saying for years that unions need to do more of. And I remember when I first started, when I was a young kid, back in the late 80s, starting in the union, I had an old timer explain to me that back in the 50s and 60s, they went on strike every at least 10 years, whether they needed to or not, simply to get people organized, to get people on the same page, to get people to walk across that threshold and know that they were fighting for something. And he said, look, even if you went out for one day, you knew you fought for something and you would never give it up. And for a couple of decades, we've given that mentality up. I think, and I want to get your thought on this, I think we're going back to those days of, hey, we've got to have direct action. We may have to take it to the streets, and because we earn more than we're getting. And at least that's where my thought process is.
I mean, Rick, you're hitting the nail right on the head. I mean, that's exactly where we're at. You could look around, Rick. You could see it. I mean, everybody in this country is tired of the BS. Everybody in all the workers that have been making wealth for all these corporations are just so fed up. And you see it with the uprising and workers at Starbucks. Okay, almost 300 stores or over 300 stores already, fought to have a union, and they still don't have a contract. Like something has to change.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. Obviously, they want a union. We're not talking about 10 or 15 stores here. We're talking over 300 stores, and they still don't have a contract. Amazon as well. Amazon, you have Teamsters and Local 396 out in California that just unionized about 84 workers. You have the big win in Staten Island by ALU and Chris Smalls. And they've had a union for over almost a year now and still have no contract as well. And it's just a game that these big corporations are paying. And it's time for people to see what a union can do. And I thought that this contract was a good, sign of that. What you can fight, what you can win for, as long as you stick together. I mean, if people only knew, Rick, that all we have to do is stand together, shoulder to shoulder against these corporations, and we can win so much from them. Because what you said in the beginning of the show, we create that wealth for them. Without that wealth, they have nothing. And without us making it for them, they have nothing. So all we have to do is threaten sometimes to withhold our labor like we did during this one-year contract campaign. It was just a year-long threat, and we were ready to. It wasn't just an empty threat. We were ready to. They just so happened to give us just about everything we wanted to stop it from happening.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing. But these other companies, listen, the workers have to start getting together. Even if you don't have a union, act like one. You have protections under the NLRA. You have protections under the LRB. You can have protected concerted activities. You can get together with your coworkers and fight against these bosses. You don't have to be scared. And listen, There's other unions out there trying to be there to help you. So don't be afraid to call on us.
I've never heard a Teamster say there are other unions out there. Good on
That's
you.
That's true.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Tony Rosario. He's an organizer with Teamsters Local 804. You can check out their website, teamsterslocal804.org. If you want to join a union, and I highly suggest the Teamsters being one of the better ones. Let me ask you this, you know, in looking at this contract, which, you know, as I said at the beginning, you got this FedEx contractor saying, hey, we got to bump things up. I got to think Amazon's going to be thinking the same way with their contractors. But the bigger point of this, and I think you hit on it a little bit, is the fact that, you know, we should be able to organize these people. I've talked to Amazon and FedEx drivers. They want to organize. But the problem is, and I think you know this as well as anyone, our laws are so badly broken. And this is where it comes back to the political part of this. You know, I say all the time we need to take off the red hats and the blue hats and put on a hard hat. But I think the only way we reunite this country is by reunionizing. And Amazon and FedEx and these giant corporations, these have got to be the targets that working people come and fight for.
You know, Rick, I couldn't have said it better myself. I love that you said the blue hats, the red hats, and the hard hats, because that's exactly it, right? It's about the hard hats. We're the ones that are working. We're the ones busting our asses. Yeah, I would love for there to be some type of workers' party, 100%, and something real and something strong. But yeah, we have a long way to go. But what I can tell you is that workers are standing together, and that's the important takeaway from this, that you have workers. Last I heard, there was a Waffle House somewhere, and the workers just had like this march on the boss. And like, I'm like, this is insane. Starbucks, Trader Joe's, Chipotle, Amazon, workers are gathering, they're fighting, they're trying to make a difference. And we need to strike while the iron's hot. We cannot let that go. It was a big win for the Teamsters as far as this TA went through. Well, when it goes through, but at the end of the day, we still have to vote on it. That's what I love about being a Teamster. It's still a democratic process. There's 340,000 workers, and I can promise you not everyone is happy about it. But at the end of the day, a lot was won. There's some emphasis on the big gains. And listen, and I'm going to be honest, I've been here 29 years, so I'm not going to bullshit you. At the end of the day, we didn't get everything we wanted, but oh my God, we got so much. And that's what we have to keep fighting for, to continue to get more, continue to secure more for our workers. If a company makes $100 billion in revenue, which is what Amazon, which was what UPS is, you know, was looking like at the end of the last few years, they got that revenue of $100 billion. Then, and we secure about $30 billion, Rick, for our workers. That's a big chunk.
Yeah.
That's enough to say, hey, you know, we got them. We want a fair contract. That's what we want. They're the golden goose. We're not trying to kill the golden goose, Rick. It's laying the eggs, you know. But I think we did a great job of choking that golden goose just a little bit to make sure we got some good eggs to hold on to over the next 5 years, Rick.
No, look, at the end of the day, you do the hard work. You're the ones out there sweating and bleeding and backs aching and bodies broken. This is how it's supposed to be. And I tell this story all the time. I started in the freight business back in the late 80s, and it was the gold standard job at the time. The LTL industry was 85% unionized. Back in those days, we were making right about what you know, in today's dollars, somewhere close to what UPS is getting paid. And over the years, as companies have been put out of business, as deregulation destroyed that industry, the wages have fallen badly. And this is where you keep talking about unions raise wages for all the industry. And I'm glad to see that, you know, in this moment, I think this UPS contract is going to be the what buoys this forward in the delivery industry, which is why I think it's so important. So last line of questioning I've got for you. Because obviously we've been talking about, you know, Starbucks and Amazon and all these places. The energy that's out there, and you're, as an organizer, you're seeing these people who want what they earn. They want a piece of the pie that they create. What advice do you give to people? So I'm going to let you put your organizer hat on here. And what advice do you give to people, you know, in their workplace? You know, what's that golden nugget, if you will, to get workers activated, engaged, and motivated?
You know what? I'm going to give you that golden nugget. And for me, it's a lot of times I'm literally talking about how I grew up in this union. I always make it a point to know a little bit about the person, and sometimes to get that person to open up, I may have to let them know a little bit about myself. And I let them know that I was a young kid in 92 when my father had just passed away. And 2 years later, I saw, my mom was doing what she had to do to pay for the mortgage on the house. And I could see she was struggling, and I knew I needed to get a job. And I was lucky enough in 94 to find a good union job, and I was able to help my mom. And it means a lot to me. And I make sure that the people that I'm talking to know that when we're fighting for a union, we're fighting for people that are out there that are just trying to make an honest living. Maybe they couldn't go to college. That's okay. Not everybody can go to college. Not everybody can be a doctor, a lawyer. There's a lot of good trade jobs out there. You can drive a truck and make an honest and good living. You can raise a family. You can get a house, and everybody should be afforded that. And those are some of the things that I go in with. And one thing that I let them know, which is the true golden nugget, Rick, is listen, I'm here for you, and I'm going to support you in any way that I can, but I cannot walk through that fire for you. You have to walk through the fire. I will support you. I will be there. I will give you what you need. I will give you the tools you need to get through it and walk through it. And I will be there on the other end with open arms when you're ready to make it through, but I can't walk it for you. A lot of times these workers think that when you're coming in to save the day, and they have to know that it's on them to do the work. As workers, we have to make sure that we know that we cannot expect other people to come and save us. We have to build that unity within our workforce. It's about building worker power. And once you have that, once you've spoken to enough people and you've built up the good force of folks that are willing to take on the boss, you take those next steps, you put in those petitions, you file those charges, you do what you have to do. And that's all legal. Just make sure you look under the, and when I talk about other unions, I mean it. Listen, the Teamsters are big, the Teamsters are strong, but at the end of the day, even we are not strong enough to take on some of these big major corporations because they have more money than you could imagine, and they will do anything, like you mentioned, about dealing with politicians, greasing those palms, making sure they get a lot taken care of for their share, and we get left with the rest that are actually looking to make a difference. And you know what? There's some good ones out there, Rick, but we got to find a few more labor-friendly politicians that are actually going to help push legislation that's going to force these corporations to do certain things. But again, if the people don't have the power to do it, it doesn't matter. You know, I can promise you, being a UPSer for 29 years, as soon as that ink dries on that contract, they're violating, and it takes a strong membership. It takes a strong membership that's going to hold the company accountable, have stewards that are educated and ready to take on the company and make sure they protect the workers, and making sure the workers know that they have rights and powers on their own without being a steward. You know, things that they can do on their own, you have to educate the workforce.
There you go. As I always say, union job, better life. That's the golden nugget. It's not the union, it's our union. That's the message. But Tony, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Great talking with you. Good on you guys with that contract. I look forward to being ratified, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Anytime, Rick. I appreciate it, and thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Tony Rosario, organizer there with Teamsters Local 804. You can check out their website, teamsterslocal804.org. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That Sunday, President Richard Nixon addressed the nation in a speech that preempted the popular television show Bonanza. His subject, the state of the economy. The speech was timed before the stock markets opened on Monday morning. The president announced a 90-day freeze to wages and prices. He took this step in an effort to curb soaring inflation. Inflation had topped 6% in 1970 and stayed above 4% the following year. The president declared, "The time has come for decisive action. Action that will break the vicious circle of spiraling prices and costs." President Nixon also announced the suspension of tying the U.S. dollar to the gold standard. The policies became known as the Nixon Shock. A cost-of-living council was established to oversee the plan. Initially, the public embraced the plan. At first, the plan seemed to help curb inflation. Many rank-and-file workers approved, but leaders from organized labor worried about how the policy would impact contract negotiations. AFL-CIO President George Meany called the plan inequitable, unjust, unfair, and unworkable. Inflation started to rise again. Nixon continued to implement similar measures for a total of nearly 1,000 days. The end result? Inflation had reached double digits by 1974. One of the impacts of these policies were that regular families had a harder time making ends meet. More women entered the workforce. During the 1970s, the dollar lost a third of its value. The Nixon shock shaped the economy of the 1970s and had a long-term negative impact on working families. In the four decades since the plan was implemented, 7 out of 10 workers have not been able to keep up with the cost of living. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. I got to tell you, I like that guy. I like him a lot. You need more people like Tony there to go out and preach the good word. And look, the reality is union job, better life. And I've told this story before. You know, as a kid growing up in a housing project, I never imagined that I would be able to lead the life that I've led. Never imagined that I would own my own home or own a car or let alone 4 or 5. I never imagined the life that job, that union job was able to afford me. And look, you know, the reality is I worked hard. I played by the rules. And because of that contract that fought for good wages, you know, not the kind of wages that kill the golden goose, but the kind of wages that you earn with health security, retirement security. And you know, look, I'm fortunate. I'm going into, you know, the final phase of my working life, knowing that, you know, when I go to retire, there's going to be something there for me because the union fought for it. There's going to be a retirement plan that I'm going to be able to, you know, with dignity, live out the rest of my years. And I want that for everyone. I don't throw that out as go, oh, look how great, look how lucky I am. I'm saying that everyone should be demanding this. And this is where, you know, in talking with Tony about the energy that you saw at UPS, the energy that you see at Starbucks or Waffle House, of people going, look, we demand better. And this is that anger that I was talking about earlier. You know, I was telling you about the guy that who dressed up like a Trump supporter and goes to these Trump rallies and is talking to Trump supporters. And you see these people because they feel comfortable with this guy. He's one of them. He's one of us. So he, you know, he obviously must know. And they feel like nobody's watching so they can be themselves. They're among their own kind. And they're talking about the things that matter to them. And while the kooky stuff is there, all of the Q stuff and all the lunacy is there. But when you get to the core, when you hear them talking about, you know, inflation's hurting us, our wages haven't kept up. Well, you know how you fight back against inflation? You have contracts that have cost of living adjustments so that you don't lose, so that you keep up, so that your standard of living isn't eroded. You have that in your contracts. And I know we've done this. We've done it before. In fact, a lot of contracts still have them. But understand, we're 6.7% of the private sector workforce, a little over 10% of the entire workforce of the country, which means that, you know, 90% of the country is struggling. The working class of this country has been taking it on the chin for far too long. And all they've been fed is on the left is, well, go get an education. Go back to school, get better skills. And on the right, it's, well, you did everything right. You're brilliant. It's those people over there. Be angry at them. And both are wrong. Both sides have gotten it wrong for too long. And look, Democrats have got to take their talking to as well in this. Republicans hate working people. Just look at what they do. But Democrats haven't always been their friends either. And this is where, looking at Joe Biden, I'm going, here's a guy who's trying. Here's a guy who's trying to do what we need him to do. All the Trump bluster around China didn't amount to a hill of beans. We got the guy who can barely get out a sentence who's actually doing something positive. That's what's important. I don't care what you say. I care about what you do. I don't care. You know, I say this all the time about Republicans. I don't care about how much, how pious you are.